And now we will have the eulogy I was unable to give by Robbie Maripol, the younger son of the Rosenbergs.
Yes, I thought that was a great rendition of Strange Fruit. I've always gotten into arguments with people because I actually like Cassandra Wilson's version better than Billie Holiday's, but I seem to be the only person. No accounting for taste. Anyway, I've not spoken at a memorial meeting for my parents sponsored by the NCRRC in several decades. That's right, several decades. There are a number of reasons for this, but one thing that kept me away was that I felt, perhaps unfairly, that past memorial meetings portrayed my parents as innocent victims. And over time, I came to view their situation as more complicated than that. But more about this later. First, I want to acknowledge another aspect of why I've joined you this evening. The NCRRC has been transformed in the last couple of years. No longer content to commemorate my parents' case, it has revived its original mission. That charge is contained in its name. It is, after all, the National Committee to Reopen the Rosenberg Case. But what does the word reopen mean today? I hope by the end of this talk to give you a sense of how today's NCRRC will apply that word. Now, I have another more personal goal on the eve of this 58th anniversary of my parents' execution. This talk is, in part, the eulogy I was too young to give when they were killed. I didn't know my parents well, but bits of information contained in the recently released grand jury minutes, Walter and Miriam Schneer's new book, Final Verdict, and Morton Sobel's startling revelations have provided me with a few additional glimpses of their lives. I'd be less than honest if I did not admit that the latest news that Morton Sobel, my father, and two others provided aeronautical information to the Soviet Union in 1948 gives me pause. My parents wrote in their last letter to me and my brother, quote, "Always remember that we were innocent and could not wrong our conscience." Now I have to ask myself, innocent of what? Right-wing Cold Warriors trumpet Sobel's recent statement as proof that my parents were liars. But it is much more complicated than that. Neither Julius nor Ethel was guilty of the crime for which they faced the executioner. Ethel was not a spy, and Julius was ignorant of the atomic bomb project. They were innocent of stealing the secret of the atomic bomb, and they were fighting for their lives. It would have been extremely difficult at the height of the McCarthy period for them to explain to their children and supporters the distinction between not being guilty of stealing atomic secrets and blanket innocence. Given that, I can understand the course of action they took from a political standpoint. But what are my personal feelings about this today? How could my parents engage in such high-risk activities that could potentially lead to their imprisonment? I was just over a year old, and my brother was five in 1948 when my father and Mort copied the secret documents. When I wrote An Execution in the Family in 2002, I thought my father might only have engaged in helping the Soviet Union fight fascism during World War II, and I asked, quote, "How many tens of thousands of American men with young children willingly went to fight during World War II, knowing that they might not survive the conflict. Was my father, whose poor eyesight disqualified him from military service, taking a greater risk by choosing this role in the battle? Now, I know that he continued to aid the Soviet Union after the end of the war. Now, I disagree with my parents' uncritical support for the USSR and the strategy my father employed to aid it after World War II. It is one thing to work to defeat Hitler or to engage in local struggles where you can see what is happening and have firsthand knowledge of the people and forces involved. But I've learned from painful experience that it is extremely difficult to judge the trustworthiness of foreign governments, not to mention our own. And knowing the terrible toll parents' activism can take on the family, I believe parents should always take their children into account when they engage in perilous activity. I wish to be clear, however, I don't think anyone engaged in what my father did during the 1940s would seriously consider that they might receive the death penalty. In any case, I do not believe it axiomatic that all parents of young children should refrain from risky activity. The Rosenberg Fund for Children, which I founded and direct, helps parents who engage the world and sometimes take dangerous actions even though they have children. Our best chance of building a more humane and just society rests on the activism of ordinary citizens with family concerns, and such activism can't always be risk-free. I question my parents' actions more than I used to, but I've had the luxury of living a much longer life than they did, and hopefully I've learned from many experiences that were foreclosed to them. I may question my parents' judgment, but I don't reject them, and I remain proud of them. Even if my father did what he could to aid the Soviet Union throughout the 1940s, and my mother supported him. Despite the awful consequences of their choices, my parents acted with integrity, courage, and in furtherance of righteous ideals, and passed their passion for social justice on to me and my brother. But how can I question my father's innocence, yet say he acted with integrity when he categorically denied his guilt? Reconciling this seeming contradiction provides the answer to this question and a starting point for understanding the rationale for the NCRRC's plan to reopen my parents' case. To understand my parents' actions, you must know something about them as people. My mother was born in 1917, my father in 1919. So they were teenagers during the depths of the Depression when Roosevelt took office in March of 1933. They were desperately poor. A friend describes how she and my mother stuffed newspaper in their shoes to block the holes in them to keep their feet from freezing as they walked to high school in the snow. My mother had a terrific singing voice. I find it ironic that she was given a special assignment of singing the national anthem at all high school assemblies. My father studied the Talmud after school, and some felt him suited to become a rabbi. Despite incredible odds, they graduated at the top of their high school's classes. My father was one of the first members of his family to enter college. Both my parents saw the world crumbling around them. They saw the meager possessions of impoverished families in their neighborhood thrown into the streets because they couldn't pay the rent. They saw the Communist Party organize squads of volunteers to break into the now empty apartments and move the families back in. They demonstrated for jobs, saw the police attack the peaceful demonstrators, and then read newspaper accounts in the capitalist press that the communists had rioted and the police restored order. They saw firsthand how the Communist Party sided with the poor and the capitalist press lied. My mother attempted to organize a union and was fired for leading a strike at her first full-time job after graduating high school. She filed a claim before the newly organized NLRB and won. My parents became young adults as Nazis rose to power, as Germany helped the fascists win in Spain, while the Roosevelt administration stood idly by. The only piece of tangible evidence seized from my parents' house introduced as evidence of a crime at my parents' trial was a tin can labeled, quote, "Save a Spanish Republican Child." They were raising money for the orphans of the Spanish Civil War. My mother took on low-paid secretarial work and sang at union rallies in the evenings. They met, married, and joined a community of young communist activists ready to engage the world as World War II started. With the passion of youth, not unlike what my wife Ellie and I felt in our SDS collective 25 years later, they carried the fight to the fascists in the most effective way they knew how, by helping the Soviet Union. My father received an engineering degree from the City College of New York. Many of his friends and political comrades had more advanced scientific training and were working in factories on cutting-edge military technology. With the Soviets bearing the brunt of the Nazi attack, sharing this information was a chance to strike a blow against the Hitler beast, as my father described him. My mother did not actively participate, but they were political partners. They and their community of young friends shared a burning desire to make the world a better place for themselves and for their children. First, they had to defeat fascism, and then they would work towards a socialist future. They weren't engaging in a political fad or merely following the crowd. This was the essence of who they were. They were not innocent victims. They were knowing political actors taking risks to further their beliefs. When repression crashed down upon them, they decided to resist rather than capitulate. They were 100% truthful when they said they acted as they did because they could not wrong our conscience. They resisted, not only for themselves, but also for their community and for their children. The government presented them with the same choice so many faced during the McCarthy period. Name names or suffer the consequences. If my parents had taken the course of David and Ruth Greenglass and ratted out their friends, in the short run, it might have been easier for me and my brother. However, in the long run, today, I am so grateful that I am the child of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg with all of the consequences. With all of the consequences of that heritage, instead of being the child of David and Ruth Greenglass, I embrace my parents' legacy of commitment and resistance, even if I might not always agree with their decisions. They acted with integrity, even if they did not tell the whole truth. But what is the impact of this new information on reopening my parents' case? Some say it is absurd to reopen the Rosenberg case when recent revelations indicate we already have all the answers. That my parents' co-defendant Morton Sobel's admissions tell us all that we need to know. My parents were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage, these people argue. And Julius not only conspired, he actually did commit espionage. Case closed. Others refute Sobel's new statements by attacking his veracity. They contend Sobel, at 93 years old, is spewing wild fantasies, or they maintain that since he denied any involvement for 60 years, admitting he lied renders any claim he makes now untrustworthy. Sometimes these people make these seemingly irreconcilable points simultaneously. I think what Sobel said is neither a fantasy nor a lie. Sobel's revelations, however, are irrelevant to the ongoing need to reopen the Rosenberg case. This is the key point. Whether or not Morton Sobel and Julius Rosenberg engaged in espionage, The government of the United States perverted our judicial process to execute two people for something they did not do. We reopened the Rosenberg case to understand fully what the government did, and because the implications of those actions are critical to us all today. The defendant's conduct sheds little light on this. We must focus on the government's conduct instead. That's what the NCRRC intends to do. And we're not only doing this just for the sake of history. My parents' case also teaches us essential lessons about today and about tomorrow. My parents, as you heard before, were charged under the Espionage Act of 1917. The 1917 Act has an infamous history. It originally served to squelch opposition to World War I. It criminalized criticism of the war effort and sent hundreds of dissenters to jail for voicing their opinions. It transformed dissent into treason. Many who attacked the law noted that the framers of the Constitution had specifically limited what constituted treason by writing it into the Constitution. Quote, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. The framers felt this narrow definition was necessary to prevent treason from becoming what some called, quote, the weapon of a political faction. It appears obvious that the Espionage Act is unconstitutional because it does exactly what the Constitution prohibits. It is, in other words, an effort to make an end run around the treason clause of the Constitution. Not surprisingly, however, as we've seen in times of political stress, shortly after its passage, the Supreme Court upheld the Espionage Act's validity in a 5-4 decision. It's no accident that Bradley Manning and Julian Assange may be charged under the same act in 2011. And it is also no accident that Manning and Assange may face a conspiracy charge, just as my parents did. All that is required of the prosecution to prove a conspiracy is to present evidence that two or more people got together and took one act in furtherance of an illegal plan. It could be a phone call or a conversation. In my parents' case, the only evidence presented against my mother was David and Ruth Greenglass's testimony that she was present at a critical espionage meeting and typed up David's handwritten description of a sketch. Although this testimony has since been shown to be false, even if it were true, it would mean that the government of the United States executed someone for typing. But the reach of conspiracy is even more insidious. It means that anyone with whom my parents discussed their actions and politics could have been swept up and had similar charges brought against them, if someone testified that those conversations included plans to commit espionage. Thus, the case against my parents was rightly seen by many in their political community of rank-and-file Communist Party members as a threat to them all. Viewing the WikiLeaks situation through this lens, it becomes apparent why the government would seek to charge Manning and Assange with conspiracy. Not only those two, but anyone involved in the WikiLeaks community could be swept up in the dragnet. Just as in my parents' case, the prosecutors could seek to bully some involved into ratting out others in return for more favorable treatment. This divide and conquer approach would turn individuals against each other, sow the seeds of distrust within the broader community, and intimidate others into quiescence. This kind of attack threatens every activist. Although later Supreme Court decisions seem to criticize and limit its scope, the Espionage Act of 1917 has never been declared unconstitutional. To this day, with a few notable exceptions that include my parents' case, it has been a sword of Damocles, awaiting the right political moment and an authoritarian Supreme Court to spring to life and slash at dissenters. And this is just one of the many ways in which lessons taught by my parents' case could impact modern-day cases. Another concerns capital punishment. While the Espionage Act of 1917 may be used to punish Bradley Manning for spreading the truth, in my parents' case, it was imposed to employ the death penalty. April 5th of this year marked the 60th anniversary of Judge Kaufman's pronouncement of the death sentence against my parents. Kaufman justified the death penalty by saying their, quote, conduct in putting into the hands of the Russians the A-bomb years before our best scientists predicted Russia would perfect the bomb has already caused, in my opinion, the communist aggression in Korea with the resulting casualties exceeding 50,000. The hoopla about Morton Sobel's recent statements serves to distract attention from Judge Kaufman's towering lie that the government of the United States knew that neither Ethel nor Julius Rosenberg stole the secret of the atomic bomb. Kaufman's statement remains as false today as it was in 1951. The FBI, the Justice Department, and Kaufman were guilty of a much more serious conspiracy than any my father was involved in. My father passed secrets to the Soviets, but the government fabricated evidence, suborned perjury, manipulated the jury, wrongfully executed two young parents. The government subverted the rule of law, violated the Constitution, and damaged our democracy. 60 years later, the government still refuses to come clean, and most of the corporate-controlled media continue to ignore this scandal. This is the basis of the NCRRC's rationale for reopening my parents' case. It does not take a genius to figure out that it's possible to be guilty of one thing and not guilty of another. My father was indicted for conspiracy to commit espionage, and in a fair judicial system, he could have been convicted and sentenced to prison for that act. At the trial, however, the prosecution, with assistance from Judge Kaufman, transformed the formal indictment into an oral charge of stealing the secret of the atomic bomb at a time when New Yorkers feared an imminent atomic attack. The fact remains that my father was innocent of that crime, and that is the crime the prosecution convinced the jury to convict him of. Interviews with several members of the jury years later confirmed this. My father knew almost nothing about the atomic bomb project and was not directly involved in stealing any atomic secrets. It is a little known fact, but the words atomic bomb never appeared in my parents' indictment. You could say that the government pulled off a legal bait and switch in their case. New evidence provided in Walter Schneer's posthumously published book, Final Verdict, verifies this conclusion. Walter discovered from reviewing research generated by the files of both the U.S. and the USSR that during the 1940s, whenever an American Soviet agent had information relating to the atomic bomb, it was transmitted within a few days to the Soviet Union. However, the sketch the Gringlasses testified about at my parents' trial, that they swore they had given to my father in September 1945, did not arrive in Moscow until late December of that year. What could cause a three-month delay? I originally believed that David never drew such a sketch until the government coerced him into doing it shortly before the trial. But Walter Schneer discovered that the sketch described in the Soviet archives contained the same errors and matched the sketch David testified he drew in his cell just a few days before the trial. That's powerful proof that Gringlass really did draw the sketch in 1945, later found in the Soviet archives. But that's not the end of the story. So Gringlass really did draw that sketch, but it didn't arrive in Moscow until almost 3 months after the supposed September 1945 meeting. Walter Schneer's explanation of this discrepancy shocked me. In January of 1945, the FBI discovered that Julius Rosenberg, who'd been working for the Army Signal Corps of Engineers, was a member of the Communist Party. In early February, he was fired from his government job. A KGB file dated February 23, 1945 stated, quote, "The latest events with Julius Rosenberg, his having been fired, are highly serious. The memo concluded that the FBI had probably discovered Julius's work for the USSR. In response, the Soviets immediately terminated Julius's career as an active agent and had all his contacts turned over to others. In other words, the KGB suspended my father from active duty in February of 1945. The supposed September 45 meeting, 7 months later, at which the Gringlasses say they gave my parents what the prosecution called the greatest secrets known to mankind, did not take place because although my father was reactivated by 1948, in September 1945, when the meeting was supposed to have occurred, he was not actively aiding the Soviet Union. Instead, the KGB files indicate that Ruth Gringlass, on her own, without my parents' involvement, met with Soviet agents on December 21, 1945, and delivered the sketch the government called The Secret of the Atomic Bomb. That's why the Gringlass sketch, which we now know was worthless, was not delivered to the Soviet Union until December 27th of that year. Imagine how my parents felt sitting in the courtroom, listening to David and Ruth Gringlass swear they gave Julius the sketch the government called The Secret of the Atomic Bomb, and that Ethel was present and typed up David's handwritten notes that accompanied the sketch, knowing that they'd not been involved in any of this. The testimony about typing was virtually the only evidence against my mother. Picture how she must have felt as the prosecutor argued for her conviction, saying that she, quote, struck the keys blow by blow against her own country, when she never saw any notes and never did any typing relating to the atomic bomb. Knowing that they were sentenced to death for something they did not do is ample justification for claiming that they were innocent. And it is ample reason to reopen the Rosenberg case. So, how do we intend to do it? Regardless of my father's actions in the 1940s, neither Ethel nor Julius Rosenberg received either a fair trial or a just sentence. Today, we work to fulfill the NCRRC's mandate, that is, reopening the Rosenberg case, by seeking a federal proclamation to redress the wrong that was done my parents. The object of this campaign would be to obtain the federal equivalent of the proclamation issued by Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis in August of 1977, the 50th anniversary of Sacco and Vanzetti's execution. That proclamation did not rely on Sacco and Vanzetti's innocence, but concluded instead that because justice was not served in their case, that any stigma and disgrace should be forever removed from the names of Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, from the names of their families and descendants. This proclamation might be timed to coincide with the 60th anniversary of my parents' execution, which would be June 19th, 2013. We already have lawyers doing the research needed to provide the legal underpinnings for such a campaign, and we need your help to spread the word of this effort and provide financial support for it. For the first time since the 1980s, since the end of our Freedom of Information Act legal action against the government, the NCRRC has a plan to reopen the Rosenberg case. We've embarked upon this course not merely to right a wrong done at the height of the McCarthy period. We seek more than cleansing from our nation the stain of the wrongful execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Just as Julius and Ethel and the generation of the 1930s struggled to build a better world for their children by defeating fascism, those in the generation of the 1960s and my children's generation engage in this anti-authoritarian effort today because it is a key component of the ongoing struggle for legal, constitutional, and human rights for all our children and all the generations that follow. Thank you.